Bring up the bodies. Disc 10.
He doesn't want to take the time to go down to Surrey to Carew's house, but it seems he must. It is a well-proportioned house put up some 30 years ago, its great hall especially splendid and much copied by gentlemen building their own houses. He has been there before with the Cardinal in his time. It looks as though since then Carew has brought Italians in to replan the gardens. The gardeners doff their straw hats to him. The walks are coming into their early summer glory. Birds twitter from an aviary. The grass is shorn as close as velvet pile. Nymphs watch him with stone eyes. Now that the business is tending one way and one way only, the Seymours have begun teaching Jane how to be a queen. "This business you get up to with doors," Edward Seymour says. Jane blinks at him. "The way you hold the door still and slide yourself around it."
"You told me to be discreet."
Jane lowers her eyes to show him what discretion means. "Now, go out of the room," Edward says. "Come back in. Like a queen, Jane." Jane sneaks out. The door creaks behind her. In the hiatus, they look at each other. The door swings open. There is a long pause, as it might be a regal pause. The doorway stands empty. Then Jane appears, inching around the corner.
"Is that better?"
"Do you know what I think?" he says. "I think that from now on Jane won't be opening her own doors. So it doesn't matter." "My belief is," Edward says, "this modesty could pall. Look up at me, Jane. I want to see your expression."
"But what makes you think," Jane murmurs, "that I want to see yours?"
In the gallery, the whole family is assembled. The two brothers, prudent Edward and hasty Tom, worthy Sir John, the old goat, Lady Marjorie, the noted beauty of her day, about whom John Skelton once penned a line, "The nine courteous and meek," he called her. The meekness is not evident today. She looks grimly triumphant, like a woman who has squeezed success from life, though it's taken her nearly 60 years to do it. Bess Seymour, the widowed sister, sails in. She has a parcel wrapped in linen in her hands.
"Master Secretary," she says, with a reverence.
She says to her brother,
"Here, Tom, hold this. Sit down, sister."
Jane sits on a stool. You expect someone to hand her a slate and begin her on ABC.
"Now," Bess says, "off with this."
For a moment, she looks as if she is attacking her sister. With a vigorous, double-handed tug, she rips off her half-moon headdress, flips up its veil, and bundles the whole into the waiting hands of her mother. Jane, in her white cap, looks naked and pained, her face as small and wan as a face on a sick bed.
"Cap off, too, and start again," Bess orders.
She drags at the knotted string under her sister's chin.
"What have you done with this, Jane? It looks as if you've been sucking it."
Lady Marjorie produces a pair of embroidery scissors. With a snip, Jane is free. Her sister whisks the cap off, and Jane's pale hair, a thin ribbon of light, streaks over her shoulder. Sir John ahems and looks away, the old hypocrite, as if he'd seen something beyond the male remit. The hair has a moment's freedom before Lady Marjorie plucks it up and wraps it around her hand, as unfeeling as if it were a hank of wool. Jane frowns as it is whipped up from her nape, coiled and crammed under a newer, stiffer cap.
"We're going to pin this," Bess says.
She works, absorbed.
"More elegant, if you can stand it."
"Never liked strings myself," Lady Marjorie says.
"Thank you, Tom,"
Bess says, and takes her parcel. She casts aside the wrappings.
"Cap tighter," she decrees.
Her mother pinches, as directed, repins. The next moment a fabric box is crammed on Jane's head. Her eyes turn up as if for help, and she utters one little bleat as the wire frames bite into her scalp.
"Well, I am surprised," Lady Marjorie says. "You've got a bigger head than I thought, Jane."
Bess applies herself to bending the wire. Jane sits mute.
"That'll do," Lady Marjorie says. "It's got a bit of give in it. Push it down. Turn up the lappets. About chin level, Bess. That's how the old queen used to like it."
She stands back to assess her daughter, now imprisoned in an old-fashioned gable hood, the kind that hasn't been seen since Anne came up. Lady Marjorie sucks in her lips and studies her daughter.
"Tilting," she pronounces.
"That's Jane, I think," Tom Seymour says. "Sit up straight, sister." Jane puts her hands to her head, gingerly, as if the construction might be hot.
"Leave it alone," her mother snaps. "You wore it before. You'll get used to it."
From somewhere, Bess produces a length of fine black veiling.
"Sit still."
She begins to pin it to the back of the box, her face absorbed. "Ouch, that was my neck," Jane says. And Tom Seymour gives a heartless laugh. Some private joke of his, too unseemly to share, but one can guess.
"I'm sorry to keep you, Master Secretary," Bess says, "but she has to get this right. We cannot have her reminding the King of, you know."
"Just take care," he thinks, uneasy. "It is only 4 months since Catherine died. Perhaps the King does not want to be reminded of her either."
"We have several more frames at our command," Bess tells her sister, "so if you really can't balance it, we can take the whole thing down and try again."
Jane closed her eyes.
"I'm sure it will do."
"How did you get them so quickly?" he asks.
"They have been put away," Lady Marjorie says, "in chests, by women like myself who knew they would be needed again. We shall not see the French fashions now, not for many a year, please God."
Old Sir John says, "The King has sent her jewels."
"Things La Anna had no use for," Tom Seymour says, "but they will all come to her soon."
Bess says,
"I suppose Anne will not want them in her convent."
Jane glances up, and now she does it. Now she meets the eyes of her brothers and pulls her gaze away again. It is always a surprise to hear her voice, so soft and so unpracticed, its tone so at odds with what she has to say.
"I do not see how that can work, the convent. First Anne would claim that she was carrying the King's child. Then he would be forced to wait on her without result, for there is never a result. After that she would think of new delays. And meanwhile none of us would be safe."
Tom says, "She knows Henry's secrets, I dare say, and would sell them to her friends the French." "Not that they are her friends," Edward says. "Not any more."
"But she would try," Jane says.
He sees them, closing ranks, a fine old English family. He asks Jane, "Would you do anything you can to ruin Anne Boleyn?" His tone implies no reproach. He's just interested. Jane considers, but only for a moment.
"No one need contrive at her ruin. No one is guilty of it. She ruined herself. You cannot do what Anne Boleyn did and live to be old."
He must study Jane now, the expression on her down-turned face. When Henry courted Anne, she looked squarely at the world, her chin tilted upwards, her shallow-set eyes like pools of darkness against the glow of her skin. But one searching glance is enough for Jane, and then she casts her eyes down. Her expression is withdrawn, brooding. He has seen it before. He has been looking at pictures these 40 years. When he was a boy, before he ran away from England, he pictured a splayed cunt chalked on a wall, or a flat-eyed saint you studied while you yawned through Sunday Mass. But in Florence, the masters had painted silver-faced virgins, demure, reluctant, whose fate moved within them, a slow reckoning in the blood. Their eyes were turned inwards to images of pain and glory. Has Jane seen such pictures? Is it possible that the masters drew from life, that they studied the face of some woman betrothed, some woman being walked by her kin to the church door? French hood, gable hood. It is not enough. If Jane could veil her face completely, she would do it, and hide her calculations from the world. "Well now," he says. He feels awkward, attracting attention back to himself. "The reason I have come. The King has sent me with a gift." It is wrapped in silk. Jane looks up as she turns it over in her hands.
"You once gave me a gift, Master Cromwell, and in those days no one else did so. You may be sure I shall remember that, when it is in my power to do you good."
Just in time to frown at this, Sir Nicholas Carew has made an entrance. He does not come into a room like lesser men, but rolls in like a siege engine or some formidable hurling device, and now, halting before Cromwell, he looks as if he wishes to bombard him.
"I have heard about these ballads," he says. "Cannot you suppress them?"
"They're nothing personal," he says. "Just warmed over libels from when Catherine was queen and Anne was the pretender. The two cases are in no way alike. This virtuous lady and that—"
Words fail Carew, and indeed her judicial status uncertain, the charges not yet framed, it is hard to describe Anne. If she is a traitor, she is, pending the verdict of the court, technically dead. Though at the Tower, Kingston reports, she eats heartily enough and giggles like Tom Seymour over private jokes.
"The king is rewriting old songs," he says, "reworking their references. A dark lady is taken out and a fair lady brought in. Jane knows how these things are managed. She was with the old queen. If Jane has no illusions, a little maid such as she, then you should get rid of yours, Sir Nicholas. You are too old for them."
Jane sits unmoving with her present in her hands, still wrapped.
"It's all right to undo it, Jane," her sister says kindly. "Whatever it is, it's yours to keep." "I was listening to Master Secretary," Jane says. "One can learn a great deal from him."
"Hardly apt lessons for you," Edward Seymour says.
"I don't know. 10 years in the train of Master Secretary, and I might learn to stand up for myself."
"Your happy destiny," says Edward, "is to be a queen, not a clerk."
"So do you," Jane says, "give thanks to God I was born a woman?"
"We thank God on our knees daily," Tom Seymour says, with leaden gallantry. It is new to him to have this meek sister require compliments, and he is not swift to respond. He gives Brother Edward a glance and a shrug. "Sorry, best I can do." Jane unwraps her prize. She runs the chain through her fingers. It is as fine as one of her own hairs. She holds the tiny book in the palm of her hand and turns it over. In the gold and black enamel of its cover, initials are studded in rubies and entwined H and A.
"Think nothing of it. The stones can be replaced," he says quickly. Jane hands him the object. Her face has fallen. She does not yet know how thrifty the king can be, this most magnificent prince. "Henry should have warned me," he thinks. Beneath Anne's initial, you can still distinguish the K. He passes it to Nicholas Carew. "You take note?" The knight opens it, fumbling with a tiny clasp.
"Ah," he says, "a Latin prayer, or a Bible verse?"
"If I may." He takes it back. "Here is the Book of Proverbs. Who can find a good, a virtuous woman? Her price is beyond rubies." Evidently it's not, he thinks. 3 presents, 3 wives, and only 1 jeweler's bill. He says to Jane, smiling, "Do you know this woman who is mentioned here? Her clothing is silk and purple," says the author. "I could tell you much more about her from verses this page cannot contain."
Edward Seymour says, "You should have been a bishop, Cromwell."
"Edward," he says, "I should have been pope." He is taking his leave when Carew crooks a peremptory finger. "Oh, Lord Jesus," he breathes to himself, "I am in trouble now for not being humble enough." Carew motions him aside, but it is not to reproach him.
"The Princess Mary," Carew murmurs, "is very hopeful of a call to her father's side. What better remedy and comfort at such a time for the king than to have the child of his true marriage in his house?"
"Mary is better where she is. The subjects discussed here, in the council and on the street, are not fit for the ears of a young girl."
Carew frowns.
"There may be something in that, but she looks to have messages from the king. Tokens."
"Tokens," he thinks, "that can be arranged."
"There are ladies and gentlemen from the court," Carew says, "who wish to ride up country to pay their respects, and if the princess is not to be conducted here, surely the terms of her confinement should be relaxed. It is hardly suitable now to have Boleyn women around her. Perhaps her old governor, the Countess of Salisbury."
Margaret Pole? That haggard papist battle-axe? But now is not the time to deliver hard truth to Sir Nicholas. That can wait. "The king will dispose," he says comfortably. "It is a close family matter. He will know what is best for his daughter." By night, when the candles are lit, Henry leaks easy tears over Mary.
But by daylight he sees her for what she is, disobedient, self-willed, still unbroken. When all this is tidied away, the king says, I shall turn my attention to my duties as father. I am sad that the Lady Mary and I have become estranged. After Anne, reconciliation will become possible, but, he adds, there will be certain conditions, to which, mark my words, my daughter Mary will adhere.
One more thing, Carew says. You must pull Wyatt in.
Instead, he has Francis Bryan fetched. Francis comes in grinning. He thinks himself the untouchable man. His eye patch is decorated with a small winking emerald, which gives a sinister effect. One green eye and the other. He examines it, says, Sir Francis, what colour are your eyes? I mean your eye.
Red, generally, Brian says, but I try not to drink during Lent, or Advent, or on Fridays.
He sounds lugubrious.
Why am I here? You know I'm on your side, don't you?
I only asked you to supper.
You asked Mark Smeaton to supper, and look where he is now.
It is not I who doubts you, he says with a heavy actor's sigh. How he enjoys Sir Francis.
It is not I, but the world at large, who asks where your loyalties lie. You are, of course, the Queen's kinsman. I am James' kinsman, too.
Brian is still at ease, and he shows it by leaning back in his chair, his feet thrust out under the table.
I hardly thought I should be interrogated.
I am talking to everyone who is close to the Queen's family, and you are certainly close. You have been with them since the early days. Did you not go to Rome, chasing the king's divorce, pressing the Boleyn's case with the best of them? But what should you fear? You are an old courtier. You know everything. Used wisely, wisely shared, knowledge may protect you. He waits. Ryan has sat up straight. And you want to please the king, he says. All I ask is to be sure that, if you are put to it, you will give evidence on any point I require. He could swear that Francis sweats Gascon wine, his pores leaking that mouldy, ropey stuff he's been buying cheap and selling dear to the king's own sellers.
Look, Crumb, Brian says, what I know is, Norris always imagined rutting with her.
And her brother, what did he imagine? Brian shrugs.
She was sent to France, and they never knew each other till they were grown. I have known such things happen, have not you?
No, I cannot say I have. We never went in for incest where I grew up. God knows we had crimes enough and sins, but there were places our fantasy did not stretch.
You saw it in Italy, I wager. Only sometimes people see it and they don't dare name it.
I dare name anything, he says calmly, as you will see. My imagination may lag behind each day's revelations, but I am working hard to catch up with them.
Now she is not queen, Brian says, because she is not. Is she? I can call her what she is, a hot minx, and where has she better opportunity than with her family?
He says, by that reasoning, do you think she goes to it with Uncle Norfolk? It could even be you, Sir Francis, if she has a mind to her relatives. You are a great gallant.
Oh, Christ, Brian says. Cromwell, you would not.
I only mention it. But as we are at one in this matter, or we appear to be, will you do me a service? You could ride over to Great Hullingbury and prepare my friend Lord Morley for what is coming. It is not the sort of news you can break in a letter, not when the friend is elderly.
You think it's better face to face?
An incredulous laugh.
My lord, I shall say, I come myself to spare you a shock. Your daughter Jane will soon be a widow because her husband is to be decapitated for incest.
No, the matter of incest we leave to the priests. It is for treason he will die, and we do not know the king will choose decapitation.
I do not believe I can do it.
But I do. I have great faith in you.
Think of it as a diplomatic mission. You have performed those, though I wonder how.
Sober, Francis Bryan says. I shall need a drink for this one. As you know, I have a dread of Lord Morley. He is always pulling out some ancient manuscript and saying, "Look here, Francis," and laughing heartily at the jokes in it. And you know my Latin. Any schoolboy would be ashamed of it.
Don't wheedle, he says. Saddle your horse. But before you ride to Essex, do me a further service. Go see your friend Nicholas Carew. Tell him I agree to his demands and I will talk to Wyatt, but warn him. Tell him not to push me because I will not be pushed. Remind Carew that there may be more arrests. I'm not yet able to say who. Or rather, if I am able, I am not willing. Understand, and make your friends understand, that I must have a free hand to deal. I am not their waiting boy.
Am I free to go?
Free as air, he says blandly. But what about supper?
You can eat mine, Francis says.
Though the king's chamber is dark, the king says,
We must look into a glass of truth. I think I am to blame, as what I suspected I did not own.
Henry looks at Cranmer, as if to say, It's your turn now. I admit my fault, so give me absolution. The Archbishop looks harrowed. He does not know what Henry will say next, or if he can trust himself to respond. This is not a night for which Cambridge ever trained him.
You were not remiss, he tells the king.
He darts a questioning look like a long needle at him, Cromwell.
In these matters, surely the accusation should not come before the evidence.
You must bear in mind, he says to Cranmer, for he is bland and easy and full of phrases, you must bear in mind that not I, but the whole council, examined the gentlemen who now stand accused. And the council called you in, laid the matter before you, and you did not demur. As you have said yourself, my Lord Archbishop, we would not have gone so far in the matter without grave consideration.
When I look back, Henry says, so much falls into place. I was misled and betrayed. So many friends lost, friends and good servants lost, alienated, exiled from court, and worse. I think of Wolsey. The woman I called my wife practiced against him with all her ingenuity, with every weapon of slyness and rancour.
Which wife would that be? Both Catherine and Anne worked against the cardinal.
I do not know why I have been so crossed, Henry says. But does not Augustine call marriage a mortal and slavish garment?
Chrysostom, Cranmer murmurs.
But let that pass. He, Cromwell, says hastily, If this marriage is dissolved, Majesty, Parliament will petition you to marry again.
I dare say it will. How may a man do his duty to both his realm and to God? We sin even in the very act of generation. We must have offspring, and kings especially must, and yet we are warned against lust even in marriage. And some authorities say, do they not, that to love your wife immoderately is a kind of adultery.
Jerome,
Cranmer whispers, as if he would just as soon disown the saint.
But there are many other teachings that are more comfortable, and that praise the married state.
Roses snatched from the thorns, he says. The church does not offer much comfort to the married man, though Paul says we should love our wives. It is hard, Majesty, not to think marriage is sinful inherently, since the celibates have spent many centuries saying that they are better than we are. But they are not better. Repetition of false teachings does not make them true. You agree, Cranmer? Just kill me now, the Archbishop's face says. Against all the laws of king and church, he is a married man. He married in Germany when he was among the reformers. He keeps Frau Greta secretly. He hides her in his country houses. Does Henry know? He must know. Will Henry say? No, because he is intent on his own plight.
Now I cannot see why I ever wanted her, the king says. That is why I think she has practiced on me with charms and enchantments. She claims she loves me. Catherine claimed she loved me. They say love and mean the opposite. I believe Anne has tried to undermine me at every turn. She was always unnatural. Think how she would taunt her uncle, my Lord of Norfolk. Think how she would scorn her father. She would presume to censure my own conduct and press on me advice in matters well beyond her understanding, and give me such words as no poor man would willingly hear from his wife.
Cranmer says,
she was bold, it is true. She knew it for a fault and would try to bridle herself. Now she shall be bridled, by God!
Henry's tone is ferocious, but the next moment he has modulated it to the plaintive accents of the victim. He opens his walnut writing box.
Do you see this little book?
It is not really a book, or not yet, just a collection of loose leaves tied together. There is no title page, but a sheet, black with Henry's own laboured hand.
It is a book in the making. I have written it. It is a play. It is a tragedy. It is my own case.
He offers it. He says, keep it, sir, till we have more leisure to do justice to it.
But you ought to know, the king insists, her nature, how ill she has behaved to me when I gave her everything. All men should know and be warned about what women are. Their appetites are unbounded. I believe she has committed adultery with 100 men.
Henry looks for a moment like a hunted creature, hounded by women's desire, dragged down and shredded.
But her brother,
Cranmer says. He turns away. He will not look at the king.
Is it likely? I doubt she could resist him,
Henry says.
Why spare? Why not drink the cup to the filthy dregs? And while she was indulging her own desires, she was killing mine. When I would approach her, only to do my duty, she would give me such a look as would daunt any man. I know now why she did so. She wanted to be fresh for her lovers.
The king sits. He begins to talk, to ramble. Anne took him by the hand these 10 years ago and more. She led him into the forest, and at the sylvan edge where the broad light of day splinters and filters into green, he left his good judgment, his innocence. She drew him on all day till he was trembling and exhausted, but he could not stop even to catch his breath. He could not go back. He had lost the path. All day he chased her until the light faded, and he followed her by the light of torches, and then she turned on him, and stifled the torches, and left him alone in the dark. The door opens softly. He looks up, and it is Ralph, where once it would have been Weston, perhaps.
Majesty, my Lord of Richmond is here to say good night. May he come in?
Henry breaks off.
Fitzroy, of course.
Henry's bastard is now a princeling of 16, though his fine skin, his open gaze, make him seem younger than his age. He has the red-gold hair of King Edward IV's line. He has a look of Prince Arthur, too, Henry's elder brother who died. He is hesitant as he confronts his bull of a father, hovering in case he is unwanted. But Henry rises and embraces the boy, his face wet with tears.
My little son,
he says to the child who will soon make 6 foot.
My only son.
The king is crying so hard now that he has to blot his face on his sleeve.
She would have poisoned you,
he moans.
Thank God that by the cunning of Master Secretary, the plot was found out in time.
Thank you, Master Secretary, the boy says formally, for finding out the plot.
She would have poisoned you and your sister Mary, both of you, and made that little blotch she spawned the heir to England, or my throne would have passed to whatever she whelped next, God save me, if it lived. I doubt a child of hers could live. She was too wicked. God abandoned her. Pray for your father. Pray God does not abandon me. I have sinned. I must have. The marriage was illicit.
What, this one was? The boy says. This one as well.
Illicit and accursed.
Henry rocks the boy back and forth, gripping him ferociously, fists clenched behind his back. So, perhaps, does a bear crush her cubs.
The marriage was outside God's law. Nothing could make it lawful. Neither of them was my wife, not this one and not the other. Thank God she is in her grave now, and I do not have to listen to her snuffling and praying and entreating and meddling in my business. Do not tell me there were dispensations. I do not want to hear it. No pope can dispense from the law of heaven. How did she ever come near me, Anne Boleyn? Why did I ever look at her? Why did she blind my eyes? There are so many women in the world, so many fresh and young and virtuous women, so many good and kind women. Why have I been cursed with women who destroy the children in their own wombs?
He lets the boy go, so abruptly that he staggers. Henry sniffs.
Go now, child, to your own guiltless bed. And you, Master Secretary, to your... back to your own people.
The king blots his face with his handkerchief.
I am too tired to confess tonight, my Lord Archbishop. You may go home too, but you will come again and absolve me.
It seems a comfortable idea. Cranmer hesitates, but he is not one to press for secrets. As they leave the chamber, Henry takes up his little book. Absorbed, he turns the pages and settles down to read his own story. Outside the king's chamber, he gives the signal to the hovering gentleman. Go in and see if he wants anything. Slow, reluctant, his body servants creep towards Henry in his lair, unsure of their welcome, unsure of everything. Past time with good company. But where's the company now? It's cringing against the wall. He takes his leave of Cranmer, embracing him, whispering, All will work for good. Young Richmond touches his arm.
Master Secretary, there is something I must tell you.
He is tired. He was up at dawn writing letters into Europe. Is it urgent, my lord?
No, but it is important.
Imagine having a master who knows the difference. Go ahead, my lord, I am all attention.
I want to tell you, I have had a woman now.
I hope that she was all you desired. The boy laughs uncertainly.
Not really. She was a whore. My brother Surrey arranged it for me.
Norfolk's son, he means. By the light of a sconce, the boy's face flickers, gold to black to cross-hatched gold again, as if he were dipped in shadows.
But this being so, I am a man, and I think Norfolk should let me live with my wife.
Richmond has already been married off to Norfolk's daughter, little Mary Howard. For reasons of his own, Norfolk has kept the children apart. If Anne had given Henry a son in wedlock, the bastard boy would be worthless to the king, and it has entered Norfolk's calculations that in that case, if his daughter was a virgin, he could perhaps marry her more usefully elsewhere. But all those calculations are needless now. I'll speak to the Duke for you, he says. I think he will now be keen to fall in with your wishes. Richmond flushes. Pleasure? Embarrassment? The boy is no fool and knows his situation, which in a few days has improved beyond all measure. He, Cromwell, can hear the voice of Norfolk, as clear as if he were reasoning in the king's council. Catherine's daughter has been made a bastard already. Anne's daughter will follow, so all three of Henry's children are illegitimate. If that is so, why not prefer the male to the female?
Master Secretary, the boy says, the servants in my household are saying Elizabeth is not even the Queen's child. They say she was smuggled into the bedchamber in a basket, and the Queen's dead child carried out.
Why would she do that? He is always curious to hear the reasoning of household servants.
It is because, to be Queen, she struck a bargain with the devil, but the devil always cheats you. He let her be Queen, but he would not let her bear a live child.
You would think the devil would have sharpened her wit, though. If she was bringing in a baby in a basket, surely she would have brought in a boy. Richmond manages a miserable smile.
Perhaps she laid hold of the only baby she could get. After all, people do not leave them in the street.
They do, though. He is bringing in a bill to the new Parliament to provide for the orphan boys of London. His idea is look after the orphan boys, and they will look after the girls.
Sometimes, the boy says, I think about the Cardinal. Do you ever think of him?
He sinks down to sit on a chest, and he, Cromwell, sits down with him.
When I was a very little child, and very foolish as children are, I used to think the Cardinal was my father.
The cardinal was your godfather.
Yes, but I thought, because he was so tender to me, he would visit me and carry me, and though he gave me great gifts of gold plate, he brought me a silk ball, and also a doll, which, you know, boys do like.
He drops his head.
When they are little children. And I am speaking of when I was still in a gown. I knew there was some secret about me, and I thought that was it, that I was a priest's son. When the king came, he was a stranger to me. He brought me a sword.
And did you guess then that he was your father?
No,
says the boy. He opens his hands to show his helpless nature, the nature he had as a little child.
No, it had to be explained to me. Do not tell him, please. He would not understand.
Of all the shocks the king has received, it could be the greatest, to know that his son did not recognize him.
Has he many other children?
Richmond asks. He speaks now with the authority of a man of the world.
I suppose he must have.
To my knowledge, he has no child who could hurt your claim. They say Mary Boleyn's son was his, but she was married at the time and the boy took her husband's name.
But I suppose he will marry Mistress Seymour now, when this marriage...
The boy stumbles over his words.
When whatever is to happen, when it happens. And she will have a son, perhaps, because the Seymours are fertile stock.
If that occurs, he says gently, you must stand ready, the first, to congratulate the king. And you must be prepared all your life to place yourself at the service of this little prince. But on a more immediate matter, if I may advise, if your living with your wife should be further delayed, it is best to find a kind and clean young woman and make an arrangement with her. Then, when you part from her, pay her some small retainer so she does not talk about you.
Is that what you do, Master Secretary?
The question is ingenuous, but for a moment he wonders if the boy is spying for someone. It is better not discussed between gentlemen, he says, and emulate your father, the king, who in speaking of women is never coarse. Violent, perhaps, he thinks, but never coarse. Be prudent and do not deal with whores. You must not catch a disease, like the French king. Then also, if your young woman gives you a child, you have its keeping and bringing up, and you know it is not another man's.
But you cannot be sure.
Richmond breaks off. The realities of the world are tumbling in fast on this young man.
If the king can be deceived, surely any man can be deceived. If married ladies are false, any gentleman could be bringing up another man's child.
He smiles. But another gentleman would be bringing up his. He means to begin, when he has time to plan it, some form of registration, documentation, to record baptisms, so he can count the king's subjects and know who they are, or at least who their mothers say they are. Family name and paternity are two different things, but one must start somewhere. He scans the faces of the Londoners as he rides through the city, and he thinks of streets in other cities where he has lived or passed through, and he wonders. I could do with more children, he thinks. He has been continent in his living as far as it is reasonable for a man to be, but the cardinal used to invent scandals about him and his many concubines. Whenever some stout young felon was dragged to the gallows, the cardinal would say, "There, Thomas, that will be one of yours." The boy yawns.
I am so tired, he says, yet I have not been hunting today, so I don't know why.
Richmond's servants are hovering, their badge a demi-lion rampant, their livery of blue and yellow faded in the failing light. Like nursemaids snatching up a child from muddy puddles, they want to sweep the young duke away from whatever Cromwell is plotting. There is a climate of fear, and he has created it. Nobody knows how long the arrests will go on and who else will be taken. He feels even he does not know, and he is in charge of it. George Boleyn is lodged in the Tower. Weston and Breton have been allowed a last night to sleep in the world, a few hours' grace to arrange their affairs. This time tomorrow the key will be turned on them. They could run, but where to? None of the men except Mark have been properly interrogated, that is to say, interrogated by him, but the scrapping for the spoils has begun. Norris had not been in ward for a day before the first letter came in, seeking a share of his offices and privileges, from a man who pleaded he had 14 children. 14 hungry mouths. not to mention the man's own needs, and the snapping teeth of his lady wife. Next day, early, he says to William Fitzwilliam, "Come with me to the tower to talk to Norris." Fitz says, "No, you go. I cannot do it a second time. I have known him all my years. The first time nearly killed me." Gentle Norris, chief bottom wiper to the king, spinner of silk threads, spider of spiders, black centre of the vast dripping web of court patronage. What a spry and amiable man he is, past 40, but wearing it lightly. Norris is a man always in equipoise, a living illustration of the art of sprezzatura. No one has ever seen him ruffled. He has the air of a man who has not so much achieved success as become resigned to it. He is as courteous to a dairymaid as to a duke, at least for as long as he has an audience. A master of the tournament ground, he breaks a lance with an air of apology, and when he counts the coin of the realm, he washes his hands afterwards in spring water scented with rose petals. Nevertheless, Harry has grown rich, as those about the king cannot help but grow rich, however modestly they strive. When Harry snaps up some perquisite, it is as if he, your obedient servant, were sweeping away from your sight something distasteful. And when he volunteers for some lucrative office, it is as if he is doing it out of a sense of duty, and to save lesser men the trouble. But look at gentle Norris now. It is a sad thing to see a strong man weep. He says so, as he sits down, and inquires after his keeping, whether he is being served with the food he likes, and how he has slept. His manner is benign and easy. "During the days of Christmas last, Master Norris, you impersonated a moor, and William Brereton showed himself half naked in the guise of a hunter or wild man of the woods, going towards the Queen's chamber."
"For God's sake, Cromwell," Norris sniffs, "are you in earnest? You are asking me in all seriousness about what we did when we were costumed for a mask."
"I counselled him, William Brereton, against exposing his person. Your retort was that the Queen had seen it many a time." Norris reddens, as he did on the date in question.
"You mistake me on purpose. You know I meant that she is a married woman, and so a man's gear is no strange sight to her."
"You know what you meant. I only know what you said. You must admit that such a remark would not strike the king's ear as innocent. On the same occasion as we were standing in conversation, we saw Francis Weston disguised, and you remarked he was going to the queen."
"At least he wasn't naked," Norris says. "In a dragon suit, wasn't he?"
"He was not naked when we saw him, I agree. But what did you say next? You spoke to me of the queen's attraction to him. You were jealous, Harry, and you didn't deny it. Tell me what you know against Weston. It will be easier for you thereafter." Norris has pulled himself together and blown his nose.
"All you are alleging is some loose words capable of many interpretations. If you are seeking proofs of adultery, Cromwell, you will have to do better than this."
"Oh, I don't know. By the nature of the thing, there is seldom a witness to the act. But we consider circumstances and opportunities and expressed desires. We consider weighty probabilities, and we consider confessions."
"You will have no confession from me, or Brereton either."
"I wonder."
"You will not put gentlemen to the torture. The king would not permit it."
"There don't have to be formal arrangements." He is on his feet. He slams his hand down on the table. "I could put my thumbs in your eyes, and then you would sing Green Grows the Holly if I asked you to." He sits down, resumes his former easy tone. "Put yourself in my place. People will say I have tortured you anyway. They will say I have tortured Mark. They are already putting the word about. Though not a gossamer thread of him is snapped, I swear. I have Mark's free confession. He has given me names. Some of them surprised me. But I have mastered myself."
"You are lying."
Norris looks away.
"You are trying to trick us into betraying each man the other."
The king knows what to think. He does not ask for eyewitnesses.
He knows your treason and the Queen's.
Ask yourself, Norris says, how likely is it that I should so forget my honour as to betray the King who has been so good to me, and to place in such terrible danger a lady I revere? My family has served the King of England time out of mind. My great-grandfather served King Henry VI, that saintly man, God rest his soul. My grandfather served King Edward, and would have served his son if he had lived to reign. And after he was driven out of the realm by the scorpion Richard Plantagenet, he served Henry Tudor in exile, and served him still when he was crowned king. I have been at the side of Henry since I was a boy. I love him like a brother. Do you have a brother, Cromwell?
None living. He looks at Norris, exasperated. He seems to think that with eloquence, with sincerity, with frankness, he can change what is happening. The whole court has seen him slobbering over the Queen. How could he expect to go shopping with his eyes and finger the goods, no doubt, and not have an account to settle at the end of it? He gets up. He walks away. He turns. He shakes his head. He sighs.
Ah, for God's sake, Harry Norris, have I to write it on the wall for you? The King must be rid of her. She cannot give him a son, and he is out of love with her. He loves another lady, and he cannot come at her unless Anne is removed. Now, is that simple enough for your simple tastes? Anne will not go quietly. She warned me of it once. She said, if ever Henry puts me aside, it will be war. So if she will not go, she must be pushed, and I must push her. Who else? Do you recognize the situation? Will you take your mind back? In a like case, my old master Wolsey could not gratify the king, and then what? He was disgraced and driven to his death. Now I mean to learn from him, and I mean the king to be gratified in every respect. He is now a miserable cuckold, but he will forget it when he is a bridegroom again, and it will not be long.
I suppose the Seymours have the wedding feast ready.
He grins. And Tom Seymour is having his hair curled. And on that wedding day the king will be happy. I will be happy. All England will be happy, except Norris, for I fear he will be dead. I see no help for it, unless you confess and throw yourself on the king's mercy. He has promised mercy, and he keeps his promises, mostly.
I rode with him from Greenwich, Norris says, away from the tournament, all that long ride. Every stride he badgered me, what have you done? Confess. I will tell you what I told him, that I am an innocent man. And what is worse,
and now he is losing his composure, he is irate.
What is worse is that you and he both know it. Tell me this. Why is it me? Why not Wyatt? Everyone suspects him with Anne, and has he ever directly denied it? Wyatt knew her before. He knew her in Kent. He knew her from her girlhood.
And so what of it? He knew her when she was a simple maid. What if he did meddle with her? It may be shameful, but it is no treason. It is not like meddling with a king's wife, the Queen of England.
I am not ashamed of any dealings I have had with Anne.
Are you ashamed of your thoughts about her, perhaps? You told Fitzwilliam as much.
Did I?
Norris says bleakly.
Is that what he took away from what I said to him? That I am ashamed? And if I am, Cromwell, even if I am, you cannot make my thoughts a crime.
He holds out his palms. If thoughts are intentions, if intentions are malign, if you did not have her unlawfully, and you say you did not, did you intend to have her lawfully after the king's death? It is getting on 6 years since your wife died. Why have you not married again?
Why haven't you?
He nods. A good question, I ask myself. But I have not promised myself to a young woman and then broken my promise, as you have. Mary Shelton has lost her honour to you. Norris laughs.
To me? To the king, rather.
But the king was not in a position to marry her, and you were, and she had your pledge, and yet you dallied. Did you think the king would die so you could marry Anne? Or did you expect her to dishonour her marriage vows during the king's life and become your concubine,
It is one or the other.
If I say either, you will damn me. You will damn me if I say nothing at all, taking my silence for agreement.
Francis Weston thinks you are guilty.
That Francis thinks anything is news to me. Why would he...
Norris breaks off.
What, is he here? In the tower?
He is in ward.
Norris shakes his head.
He is a boy. How can you do this to his people? I admit he is a careless, headstrong boy. He is known to be no favourite of mine. It is known we have cut across each other.
Ah, rivals in love. He puts his hand to his heart.
By no means!
Ah, Harry is ruffled now. He has flushed darkly. He is trembling with rage and fear.
And what do you think to Brother George? He asks him.
You may have been surprised to encounter rivalry from that quarter.
I hope you were surprised, though the morals of you gentlemen astonish me.
You do not trap me that way. Any man you name, I will say nothing against him and nothing for him. I have no opinion on George Boleyn.
What? No opinion on incest? If you take it so quietly and without objection, I am forced to conjecture there may be truth in it.
And if I were to say, I think there might be guilt in that case, you would say to me, why, Norris, incest? How can you believe such an abomination? Is it a ploy to lead me away from your own guilt?
He looks at Norris with admiration. Not for nothing have you known me 20 years, Harry.
Oh, I have studied you, Norris said, as I studied your master Wolsey before you.
That was politic in you, such a great servant of the state.
And such a great traitor at the end.
I must take your mind back. I do not ask you to remember the manifold favours you received at the cardinal's hands. I only ask you to recall an entertainment, a certain interlude played at court. It was a play in which the late cardinal was set upon by demons and carried down to hell. He sees Norris's eyes move as the scene rises before him. The firelight, the heat, the baying spectators, himself and Boleyn grasping the victim's hands, Brereton and Weston laying hold of him by his feet, the four of them tossing the scarlet figure, tumbling him and kicking him, four men who for a joke turned the cardinal into a beast, who took away his wit, his kindness and his grace, and made him a howling animal, grovelling on the boards and scrabbling with his paws. It was not truly the cardinal, of course. It was the jester sexton, in a scarlet robe. But the audience catcalled as if it had been real. They yelled and shook their fists. They swore and mocked. Behind a screen, the four devils pulled off their masks and their hairy jerkins, cursing and laughing. They saw Thomas Cromwell leaning against the panelling, silent, wrapped in a robe of mourning black. Now, Norris gapes at him.
And that is why? It was a play. It was an entertainment, as you said yourself. The cardinal was dead. He could not know. And while he was alive, was I not good to him in his trouble? Did I not, when he was exiled from court, ride after him and come to him on Putney Heath with a token from the king's own hand?
He nods. I concede that others behaved worse. But you see, none of you behaved like Christians. You behaved like savages instead, falling on his estates and possessions. He sees he need not continue. The indignation on Norris's face is replaced by a look of blank terror. At least, he thinks, the fellow has the wit to see what this is about. Not 1 year's grudge or two, but a fat extract from the Book of Grief, kept since the cardinal came down. He says, life pays you out, Norris, don't you find? And, he adds gently, it is not all about the cardinal either. I would not want you to think I am without motives of my own. Norris raises his face.
What has Mark Smeaton done to you?
Mark? He laughs. I don't like the way he looks at me. Would Norris understand if he spelled it out? He needs guilty men, so he has found men who are guilty, though perhaps not guilty as charged. A silence falls. He sits. He waits.
his eyes on the dying man. He is already thinking what he will do with Norris's offices, his crown grants. He will try to oblige the humble applicants, like the man with 14 children who wants the keeping of a park at Windsor and a post in the administration of the castle. Norris's offices in Wales can be parcelled out to young Richmond, and that will bring the posts in effect back to the king and under his own supervision. And Ralph could have the Norris estate at Greenwich. He could house Helen and the children there when he has to be at court. And Edward Seymour has mentioned he would like Norris's house in Kew. Harry Norris says,
"I assume you will not just lead us out to execution. There will be a process, a trial, yes? I hope it will be quick. I suppose it will. The Cardinal used to say, Cromwell will do in a week what will take another man a year. It is not worth your while to block him or oppose him. If you reach out to grip him, he will not be there. He will have ridden 20 miles while you are pulling your boots on."
He looks up.
"If you intend to kill me in public and mount a show, be quick, or I may die of grief alone in this room."
He shakes his head. "You'll live." He once thought it himself that he might die of grief, for his wife, his daughters, his sisters, his father, and Master the Cardinal. But the pulse, obdurate, keeps its rhythm. You think you cannot keep breathing, but your ribcage has other ideas, rising and falling, emitting sighs. You must thrive in spite of yourself. And so that you may do it, God takes out your heart of flesh and gives you a heart of stone. Norris touches his ribs.
"The pain is here. I felt it last night. I sat up breathless. I durst not lie down again."
"When he was brought down, the Cardinal said the same. The pain was like a whetstone," he said. "A whetstone, and the knife was drawn across it. And it ground away till he was dead." He rises, picks up his papers, inclining his head, takes his leave. Henry Norris, left forepaw. William Brereton, gentleman of Cheshire, servant in Wales to the young Duke of Richmond, and a bad servant too, a turbulent, arrogant, hard-as-nails man from a turbulent line.
"Let's go back," he says. "Let's go back to the Cardinal's time, because I do remember someone of your household killed a man during a bowls match."
"The game can get very heated," Brereton says. "You know yourself. You play, I hear."
"And the Cardinal thought, it is time for a reckoning, and your family were fined because they impeded the investigation. I ask myself, has anything changed since then? You think you can do anything because you are the Duke of Richmond's servant, and because Norfolk favours you."
"The King himself favours me."
He raises his eyebrows.
"Does he? Then you should complain to him. Because you are ill-lodged, are you not? Sadly for you, the king is not here, so you must make do with me and my long memory. But let us not cast back for instances. Look, for instance, at the case of the Flintshire gentleman, John Ap Ayton. That is so recent you have not forgot it."
"So that is why I am here,"
Brereton says.
"Not entirely, but leave aside now your adultery with the Queen and concentrate on Ayton. The facts of the case are known to you. There is a quarrel, blows exchanged, one of your household ends up dead. But the man Ayton is tried in due form before a London jury and is acquitted. Now, having no respect for either law or justice, you swear revenge. You have the Welshman abducted. Your servants hang him out of hand. All this—" "Do not interrupt me, man. All this with your permission and contrivance. I give this as one instance. You think this is only one man and he doesn't matter, but you see, he does. You think a year or more has passed and no one remembers, but I remember. You believe the law should be what you would like it to be, and it is on that principle that you conduct yourself in your holdings on the marches of Wales, where the king's justice and the king's name are brought into contempt every day. The place is a stronghold of thieves."
"You say I am a thief?"
"I say you consort with them. But your schemes end here."
"You are judge and jury and hangman, is that it?"
"It is better justice than Ayton had."
And Brereton says,
"I concede that."
What a fall this is. Only days ago, he was petitioning Master Secretary for spoils, when the Abbey lands in Cheshire should be given out. Now, no doubt, the words run through his head, the words he used to Master Secretary when he complained of his high-handed ways. "I must tutor you in realities," he had said coldly. "We are not creatures of some lawyer's conclave at Gray's Inn. In my own country, my family upholds the law, and the law is what we care to uphold." Now he, Master Secretary, asks, "Do you think Weston has had to do with the Queen?"
"Perhaps."
Breton looks as if he hardly cares, one way or the other. "I barely know him. He is young and foolish and good-looking, isn't he? And women regard these things. And she may be a queen, but she is only a woman. Who knows what she might be persuaded to?"
"You think women more foolish than men?"
"In general, yes. And weaker, in matters of love."
"I note your opinion.
What about Wyatt, Cromwell? Where is he in this?"
"You are in no place," he says, "to put questions to me."
William Brereton, left hind paw. George Boleyn is well past 30, but he still has the sheen we admire in the young, the sparkle, and the clear gaze. It is hard to associate his pleasant person with the kind of bestial appetite of which his wife accuses him, and for a moment he looks at George and wonders if he can be guilty of any offences, except a certain pride and elation. With the graces of his person and mind, he could have floated and hovered above the court and its sordid machinations, a man of refinement moving in his own sphere, commissioning translations of the ancient poets and causing them to be published in exquisite editions. He could have ridden pretty white horses that curvet and bow in front of ladies. Unfortunately, he liked to quarrel and brag, intrigue and snub. As we find him now, in his light circular room in the Martin Tower, we find him pacing, hungry for conflict. We ask ourselves, does he know why he is here? Or is that surprise still to come? "You are perhaps not so much to blame," he says, as he takes his seat, he, Thomas Cromwell. "Join me at this table," he directs. "One hears of prisoners wearing a path through stone, but I do not believe it can really happen. It would take 300 years, perhaps." Boleyn says, "You are accusing me of some sort of collusion, concealment, concealing misconduct on my sister's part. But this charge will not stand, because there was no misconduct."
"No, my lord, that is not the charge."
"Then what?"
"That is not what you are accused of. Sir Francis Bryan, who is a man of great imaginative capacities."
"Bryan!" Boleyn looks horrified. "But you know he is an enemy of mine."
His words tumble over each other.
"What has he said? How can you credit anything he says?"
"Sir Francis has explained it all to me, and I begin to see it. How a man may hardly know his sister and meet her as a grown woman. She is like himself, yet not. She is familiar, yet piques his interest. One day his brotherly embrace is a little longer than usual. The business progresses from there. Perhaps neither party feels they are doing anything wrong, till some frontier is crossed. But I myself am far too lacking in imagination to imagine what that frontier could be."
He pauses.
"Did it begin before her marriage or after?"
Boleyn begins to tremble. It is shock. He can hardly speak.
"I refuse to answer this."
"My lord, I am accustomed to dealing with those who refuse to answer."
"Are you threatening me with a rack?"
"Well, now, I didn't rack Thomas More, did I? I sat in a room with him. A room here at the Tower, such as the one you occupy. I listened to the murmurs within his silence. Construction can be put on silence. It will be."
George says, "Henry killed his father's counsellors. He killed the Duke of Buckingham. He destroyed the Cardinal and harried him to his death and struck the head off one of Europe's great scholars. Now he plans to kill his wife and her family and Norris, who has been his closest friend. What makes you think it will be different with you, that are not the equal of any of these men?"
He says, "It ill becomes anyone of your family to evoke the Cardinal's name, or Thomas More's, for that matter.
Your lady sister burned for vengeance. She would say to me, "What, Thomas More? Is he not dead yet?"
Who began this slander against me? It is not Francis Bryan, surely. Is it my wife? Yes, I should have known.
You make the assumption. I do not confirm it. You must have a guilty conscience towards her if you think she has such cause to hate you.
And will you believe something so monstrous, George begs, on the word of one woman?
There are other women who have been recipients of your gallantry. I will not bring them before a court if I can help it. I can do that much to protect them. You have always regarded women as disposable, my lord, and you cannot complain if in the end they think the same of you.
So am I to be put on trial for gallantry? Yes, they are jealous of me. You are all jealous. I have had some success with women.
You still call it success? You must think again.
I never heard it was a crime to spend time with a willing lover.
You had better not say that in your defence. If one of your lovers is your sister, the court will find it, what shall we say, pert and bold, lacking in gravity. What would save you now, I mean what might preserve your life, would be a full statement of all you know about your sister's dealings with other men. Some suggest there are liaisons which would put yours in the shade, unnatural though it may be.
You are a Christian man, and you ask me this? To give evidence to kill my sister?
He opens his hands. I ask nothing. I only point out what some would see as the way forward. I do not know whether the king would incline to mercy. He might let you live abroad, or he might grant you mercy as to the manner of your death. Or not. The traitor's penalty, as you know, is fearful and public. He dies in great pain and humiliation. I see you do know. You have witnessed it. Boleyn folds into himself, narrowing himself, arms across his body as if to protect his guts from the butcher's knife, and he slumps to a stool. He thinks, "You should have done that before. I told you to sit. You see how, without touching you, I have made you sit?" He tells him softly, "You profess the gospel, my lord, and that you are saved. But your actions do not suggest you are saved."
"You may take your thumbprints off my soul," George says. "I discuss these matters with my chaplains."
"Yes, so they tell me. I think you have become too assured of forgiveness, believing you have years ahead of you to sin, and yet, though God sees all, he must be patient, like a waiting man. And you will notice him at last and answer his suit, if only he will wait till you are old. Is that your case?"
"I will speak to my confessor about that."
"I am your confessor now. Did you say, in the hearing of others, that the king was impotent?" George sneers at him.
"He can do it when the weather is set fair."
"In doing so, you called into question the parentage of the Princess Elizabeth. You will readily see this is treason, as she is the heir to England."
"Faute de mieux, as far as you're concerned."
"The king now believes he could not have a son from this marriage, as it was not lawful. He believes there were hidden impediments and that your sister was not frank about her past. He means to make a new marriage, which will be clean."
"I marvel you explain yourself," George says. "You never did so before."
"I do so for one reason, so that you can realize your situation and entertain no false hope. These chaplains you speak of, I will send them to you. They are fit company for you now."
"God grants sons to every beggar," George says. "He grants them to the illicit union as well as the blessed, to the whore as well as the queen. I wonder that the king can be so simple."
"It is a holy simplicity," he says. "He is an anointed sovereign, and so very close to God." Boleyn scrutinizes his expression, for levity or scorn. But he knows his face says nothing. He can rely on his face for that. You could look back through Boleyn's career and say, there he went wrong. And there. He was too proud, too singular, unwilling to bridle his whims or turn himself to use. He needs to learn to bend with the breeze, like his father. But the time he has to learn anything is running out fast. There is a time to stand on your dignity, but there is a time to abandon it in the interests of your safety. There is a time to smirk behind the hand of cards you have drawn, and there is a time to throw down your purse on the table and say, "Thomas Cromwell, you win." George Boleyn. Right forepaw.
This ends Disc 10.